Welcome to Appaloosa Radio, where stories come alive. Appaloosa Radio is a service of the Appaloosa Springs Audio Theater.
Appaloosa Radio is pleased to introduce Nell Trustman and her collection of Broken Tree Tales. Nell Trustman was a prolific Western author who journeyed over 300,000 bumpy miles during the early 1950s to gather stories about the forgotten ghost towns of the Old West. She published many of her stories in her own magazine, The Broken Tree Tales. She pushed her red 1947 Mercury, which she named Old Bess, through washed-out gullies, up sand hills, and along long neglected wagon trails. Her only companion in her travels was her collie dog Prospector. Nell camped under the stars when the weather permitted, or slept in Old Bess when it rained or snowed. She recorded her stories wherever she happened to be on her dependable portable Royal typewriter. Appaloosa Radio has been granted exclusive rights to Nell Trustman's Broken Tree Tales.
The old and very rough pencil sketch is getting hard to make out. It shows a woman's body lying on a wooden floor. Her pantaloons have been pulled down. And she has one arm raised. Probably to fend off her attacker. She lies in a pool of her own blood. From the old pencil sketch, you would not know that it is a drawing of Miss Julia Bulett, early Nevada's most famous and beloved soiled dove. Miss Julia. A Nell Trustman story. My longtime friend called me and asked me to come up to Reno and help him celebrate. His book on Virginia City's infamous Lady of the Night, Miss Julia Bulett, had just been published. Those of us who spend substantial amounts of time in the dusty stacks of city and university libraries, peering through the yellowed pages of old newspapers, often develop a special kinship for each other. I knew that Doug McDougall had been working on his book for over 2 years. I was more than happy to motor up the US 395 highway and enjoy a steak dinner with him. At dinner, we talked about everything except his new book. Of course, he had brought a copy along for me, and I asked him to sign the inside cover. "Let me know what you think," was his cheerful, parting comment. For some reason that I could not initially explain, I felt that I did not want to read Doug's book. I admired the fine art on the dust cover and his handsome photograph, but I did not open it. He is an excellent historian and always does a first-rate job retelling stories of the past. I had been a reviewer for two of his previous books and had pronounced them both superb, excellent, and first-rate. Still, for reasons that I could not yet put my finger on, I felt uncomfortable with the Miss Julia book. It remained unopened for a full month. On one of my trips out to the desert hinterlands, I kept asking myself what was keeping me from reading and reviewing my friend's book. Self, I said to myself, what is going on here? Do you need to lay down on a couch for an hour and tell your dreams to a Dr. Freud so she can analyze them? Myself answered my own self, saying that was silly. Besides, it would be a waste of $50 that could be used for better purposes. I have always found that my disposition improves considerably after one of those self-to-self conversations. And, driving old Bess on a dirt road, 75 miles from the nearest inhabited town, helps too. About 5 miles up the washed-out road that I was navigating to an old, long-forgotten mine, I realized what I had been feeling about Doug's book. Even though I had never written about her, as a woman writer whose turf is the West, I had declared Miss Julia Bulette as my own. Ever since I first started in this strange business, I had been fascinated by the life and the murder of early Nevada's most notorious woman. In my mind, I had always planned to do an extended piece on her, but had never actually started it. It was an uncompleted intention. I was disappointed that Doug, being the really terrific historian that he is, had probably dug out all of the details and there was no more for me to tell. He had beat me to it. Driving an old red motor car on long-forgotten goat paths does strange things to the human brain. At least it does to mine. Bouncing around from the rough terrain, my fevered brain came up with a plan that most practical Nevada folks would say is both crazy and certainly not needed. I decided not to read Doug's book. Instead, I would do my own research, starting from scratch, and then write my own story. Once I had finished my version, I would read Doug's book, and then compare the two. I saw it as a reporter's challenge. Ready, to the mark. Let the games begin. Anyone who has visited Virginia City recently knows that it has recast itself to become a tourist destination. What had been a dilapidated has-been of a mountain mining town is bustling with new businesses. Saloons that almost seem like the real thing, and a willing company of Western characters carrying Colt 6 guns. Beards, boots, and cowboy hats abound. And, being Nevada, the one-arm bandits are always ready to steal the tourists' quarters and dimes. If you take the $5 Jeep tour, you are shown both Julia Bulette's tiny house and her grave in the so-called Flowery Hill Cemetery. When Miss Julia was buried there, it was not a cemetery, just a played-out claim about a half mile from town. As a woman of the night, she was denied burial in consecrated ground closer to town. On the Jeep tour, you will be regaled with stories about how Miss Julia had risked her own life to nurse miners back to health, paying for their medicines out of her own pocket, and never asking for repayment. You will also be told of her role on Engine Company No. 1, often serving as the brakeman for the fire wagon as it sped to fires. Her funeral was held at the firehouse, and over 100 volunteer firefighters served as her honorary pallbearers, all singing "The Girl I Left Behind." You will learn that the whole town draped itself in black and all of the saloons closed for an hour to honor her memory. According to the $5 tour, Miss Julia's funeral procession was the grandest that Virginia City ever saw. The Metropolitan Brass Band marched behind the hearse, playing mournful music. The band was followed by the fire company, marching on foot, and at least 20 carriages carrying the town's dignitaries. Her casket was solid mahogany, with a silk lining and solid silver handles. Flowers of every kind draped the casket. The tour stops at the historic Piper Opera House, which is now being restored. We are told that Miss Julia was a talented seamstress, and she made most of the costumes for the Opera House productions. Her murderer was later identified as an unemployed French baker. A number of Miss Julia's possessions were found in his rented room. On that evidence, he was tried and hung. As a final tidbit from the historical Jeep tour, you learn that Mark Twain observed the hanging. Miss Julia's story is for Virginia City, a made-to-order opportunity for capturing tourist cash. A couple of weeks after I tasked myself with finding the authentic story of Miss Julia Bulette, a friend invited me to her house and we watched the new television show Gunsmoke. The producers of the show claim that it is an adult western, dealing with themes from a mature perspective. In that context, my friend casually commented that the character Miss Kitty in the television show was said to be closely modeled on Julia Bulette. Not to destroy my friend's illusions, the real Miss Julia would not wear feathers, or face makeup. She would not carry a parasol or wear fancy jewels. Her dress would not be low cut, or made of silk. It would not have a red, or a lavender color. Most importantly, Miss Kitty, and the real Julia Bulette, would be on different rungs of the ladder of Old West era prostitution. First, a little sociology of Western prostitution. Nearly every Western community, be it cow towns like Dodge City or mining towns like Virginia City, had four distinguishable social layers to their prostitution industries. At the highest level, the one occupied by the character Miss Kitty in the television show Gunsmoke, were the frail but fair women who worked in the posh parlor houses, opulent establishments with ornate fixtures and furnishings, high-quality bourbon, and a piano man for entertainment. The bordello's customers would be met at the door by a massive doorman, and then be shown into the parlor where the madam would greet them and prepare them a drink. She would size up the customer's pocketbook, and make him feel at ease. Once she had charted the customer's financial value, she would ring a bell and all the available girls would appear, standing in a line. Often, the girls would array themselves on a stairway, with the highest price at the top and the lowest price at the bottom. It was in the parlor house bordellos that the women wore the kinds of wardrobe that Miss Kitty wears, tight-fitting silk and taffeta outfits, often in red, black, and purple, feathers in their hair, and facial makeup that flatters their eyes and mouth. The next social level was that of the single woman who lived in private, rented rooms and entertained only one gentleman at a time. The women at this social level had a limited clientele of regulars. Often the gentleman would spend the whole night, and sometimes the couple would go out together in public for a dinner or an evening of entertainment at the local theater or music hall. Much more like a kept mistress than a prostitute, These women were often described as being discreet, since they did not flaunt their sexuality or dress to entice men. They seldom entertained the rowdies, and they attempted to maintain a veneer of respectability. The third level is that of the streetwalker or common bar girl. In the Old West, such women were often called hurdies, which is a derogatory Scottish word meaning buttocks or haunches. Sometimes a hurdy worked for a pimp, but not always. Their encounters with men were often brief, often either in a dark alley or a cramped crib. Women of this social class were very vulnerable, very subject to disease and abuse, and tended to service the needs of the average miner or cowboy. The final, and lowest level, was reserved for Chinese women who were imprisoned in the various Chinatowns of the West. Chinese prostitution was often closely linked to the opium dens. News accounts of the time report that the women in the Chinatowns would service a customer for 50 cents or a quarter, and then be forced to turn it all over to their masters. After Julia Bulette's murder, the newspapers and pulp magazines sensationalized her life, describing her in ways that did not in any way match the known facts. The woman who came to Virginia City in the early 1860s and was known there as Julia Bulette was first and foremost a seamstress, a woman who made stylish clothes for other women. She also had a group of gentlemen friends that she regularly entertained in her tiny two-room rented home. For both, she accepted payment for her time and her services. However, she was very discreet in her activities, not drawing attention to herself or to her customers. She did not flaunt her sexuality or dress to entice men. She never walked the streets, rolled a drunk, or tried to pick up a man in a saloon. She would have strongly objected to being called a hurdy. She maintained an air of respectability about her. Because of her close ties to the various well-heeled gents who served as volunteer firefighters on Engine Company No. 1, we assume that some of those gents were also her regulars. But the number of regulars was not in the thousands, or hundreds. A good guess might be 5 to 10. What was not mentioned in the sensationalist press was that Julia Bulette probably made as much money from her dressmaking as from her prostitution. So, the truth was that the woman known as Julia Bulette in Virginia City, Nevada was a seamstress who also served in the volunteer fire department. She was sexually intimate with some of the men who also served on the fire wagon. She was paid for her services. But, she was not the legendary figure that the press made her out to be. Remember, the press guys knew how to use a story to sell newspapers or magazines. A murdered prostitute. We can make some money off that. As a result, her story persisted and was told and retold over the West and then across the whole country. Again, thank the press boys. But, reality was not enough. After Julia Bulette's gruesome murder, the newspapers and the pulp magazines sensationalized her life, creating absurd fictions completely unrelated to the easily known facts. In one popular California magazine, Miss Julia Bulette was described as the evil queen of Virginia City's seedy underworld, claiming that she owned multiple saloons and a world-class brothel with 20 women, and that she had men killed at her simple command. In another, she was the Bordello Queen of Nevada. Men swooned when they saw her radiant beauty. She rode everywhere in a special coach, pulled by four matched horses. On the side of the coach was her personally designed crest, a rising sun behind playing cards showing four aces. She had multiple servants, including a Creole maid who was even more beautiful than she was. She wore the finest Russian furs, had diamonds the size of your thumb, wore emerald earrings the size of a half-dollar coin, said to be stolen from an Indian Raj. Another story claimed that she was the very first white woman in the Nevada Territory. During one Indian raid, 50 brave men dropped their pickaxes and picked up their guns to protect her. With stories like those circulating about her, it is not surprising that Julia Bulette was selected by today's television writers as a model for their own characters. Unfortunately, almost none of those stories were true. A good story lasts far longer than truth, Mark Twain is supposed to have said. She never had a carriage or servants. She never owned furs or jewels. Her rented house was very plain and simple. Her most prized possessions were her trunk full of fabric, and her book of dress patterns. There is no evidence that she either owned a fancy gambling hall or that she ever placed a bet in one. She owned no bordello, had no velvet curtains, and never owned silk sheets. She was not a madam with 20 beautiful girls working for her. Her male customers did not pay for her services with gold bullion. She never charged any man $1,000 a night. Her murder was not discovered by her personal maid, but by the woman living next door. She made nearly all the costumes for John Piper's Opera House, and had a number of dressmaking clients who were women from prominent families. Many of the carriages that followed her funeral hearse carried women who had been her dressmaking customers. When Bulette's estate was settled, she had assets worth about $800, but her bills were substantially above that. Miss Julia Bulette's body was found on the morning of January 20, 1867. 5 months later, a French-speaking out-of-work baker was charged with her murder. He had been arrested for savagely attacking a local prostitute outside a saloon. When the town marshal searched the baker's lodgings, they found many items that were said to belong to Bulette. At the baker's trial, the prosecutor told the jury, "True, she was a woman of easy virtue. Yet, hundreds in this city have cause to bless her name for her many acts of charity. That woman probably had more real, warm friends in this community than any other." A recurring theme in Bulette's story is the number of people who genuinely liked her. The words generous, kind-hearted, and caring were often used to describe her. During the height of the Civil War, a Nevada store owner, R.C. Gridley, decided to raise money to provide clean hospitals and medical care for wounded Union troops by selling and reselling a single sack of flour. The so-called Austin Sanitary Flour Sack was decorated with some bunting and ribbons and then taken from town to town to raise money for the cause. Eventually, Gridley was able to raise nearly $275,000 for the veterans' hospitals. In Virginia City, Miss Julia Bulette carried the sack around town, raising considerable sums of money for the relief fund. She was accompanied by members of Fire Engine Company No. 1. The photograph was taken sometime during the middle of the 1860s. In it, Bulette is standing absolutely straight and has the stern look that was required in all formal photographs. Her hair is in two tight buns on either side of her head with a part down the middle. Next to her is a fireman's helmet. She is also wearing a fireman's shirt complete with the double row of brass buttons and the soft necktie. Below the fireman's shirt is her full flowing skirt of a dark color. Around her waist is a fireman's belt. Without any doubt, Miss Julia Bulette is more than proud to be an honorary member of Fire Engine Company No. 1. In my search, I found a number of newspaper stories describing her as a participating member of the engine company during actual fires. She was described as manning the brake on the large hand pumper, a very physically demanding role. She carried hoses, hitched and unhitched the horses, and helped the unit maintain its flow of water. One article described her as the first to respond to the fire alarm. In 1862, Fire Engine Company No. 1 had made her its May Queen. She rode on the engine, which was all decked in various flowers during the parade. The men of the engine company loved her easy camaraderie. Most often she seemed like one of the boys. She enjoyed their rough humor and was never afraid of the hard work. If she did not wear a skirt, they seemed to feel she would be one of them. But since she was a woman, well, that had its distinct advantages too. There seems to be some agreement among the many historical sources that she was born in 1831 or 1832. But where she was born seems a complete mystery. Some sources have her coming from England. Some say Liverpool, others say London. One well-known historian says that she accompanied her father from England to New Orleans, where he established a number of business enterprises. A more recent telling says that she was born in Louisiana and had a Creole mother. One version based on the genealogy of the name Boulette has her coming from a rich cotton planter family in the Mississippi Delta. Then, there are those who say she was the unwanted daughter of a California prostitute. Personally, I think all of these claims miss an essential reality about women living in the raw and untamed West. They often changed their names and their identities as they moved from place to place. There were a myriad of reasons for doing so. Escaping an abusive boyfriend, or pimp, to hide a crime, possibly an embezzlement or theft, to keep their family from back their knowing of their whereabouts, or to create an aura of mystery, which was always good for business. One of the most common reasons for changing a woman's name was to avoid the bill collectors, often called bounty agents, who were sent to pursue women for not paying their debts. So I now believe that the woman known in Virginia City as Miss Julia Boulette during the middle 1860s probably had other names in other places. I do not know where she came from, although it is highly likely that she had worked as a prostitute in other mining towns. She was in her 30s when she arrived in Virginia City. It was not uncommon for women to enter prostitution in their mid-teens. The description "experienced prostitute" seems most accurate. Yet, by all accounts, she was a skilled seamstress, a complex and skilled occupation. In the 1840s and 1850s, those skills could be learned only through a long apprenticeship with master craftswomen. We do not know where that apprenticeship was served, but obviously it had to be in a place where there were a sufficient number of women with the substantial financial resources needed to buy custom-made dresses. Such a place would not have been in the wilds of Nevada or California in the 1850s. One possibility that a close friend recently suggested was that the woman known as Julia Boulette may have received her seamstress training at a Catholic orphanage. There are several well-known Catholic orphanages for young women that provided such training to their wards. My cursory research places such orphanages in New York and Baltimore. But then how would a 15 or 16-year-old girl get from there to the brothels of the West? On the other hand, the easy manner that Julia Boulette had with hard-working men may suggest that she may have grown up with older brothers. She was tall, physically strong, and fully capable of work that the men of her day did. She was not a frail female wearing frills, smelling of Florida water and flitting her fan. She was one of the boys. Roughhousing with them, sharing their coarse humor, doing the hard work that needed doing. It has been my experience that such attributes come from work among men, carrying one's own load on a full day's work. Maybe she grew up on a cattle ranch or on a farm or in a lumber camp. Again, we simply do not know. find myself reflecting again and again about Julia Bulette's last day. What we now know is really far less than what we do not. We know that she had been sick for a couple of months. We have her unpaid doctor bills as evidence. In mid-January, she began to feel better. The evening before her murder, she went to Piper's Opera House for a concert. She sat in what had been her usual seat. But someone objected to her being in the section reserved for the decent citizenry. An usher insisted that she move down to the section designated for the hurdies. Bulette strongly objected to being moved, and instead, left the theater altogether. We know that she had dinner and then went to her house. The next morning, her bloody body was found by a neighbor. She was wearing her nightgown, and her pantaloons were torn off her. The marshal assumed that she had been robbed and raped. However, many questions linger. Would she have gone to the opera house alone? My writer's intuition is no. My thought is that someone who cared for her, someone who had known that she had been sick and was now getting better, that someone invited her to go with him to the opera house. My guess is that the someone would be one of the gentlemen who was a regular customer of hers. Most likely, it would have been one of the men from Fire Company No. 1. At the opera house, the two of them sat in the same seats they always had in the section reserved for the decent citizenry. Since Bulette had designed and made most of the costumes that Piper used in his opera house, her regular seat was probably fairly prominent. The usher's demand that she move down to the area reserved for the hurdies was an affront to her social status. It was the kind of demotion that she could not tolerate. I believe that she left the theater angry. Really, really angry. Would her someone also accompany her to dinner? Possibly to help assuage her hurt feelings. After all, the night out had been planned to celebrate her return to better health. Up to this point, my speculation seems on solid ground. But, after this, my certainty erodes. Could the someone have walked Miss Bulette home, given her a good night hug, and then left as she unlocked her front door? In that case, she would have been alive and well at 9 p.m. Then, an unknown intruder broke into her home and committed the heinous crime, sometime after that good night embrace. Or more darkly, could the someone have gone inside with her? In this case, I imagine that some kind of argument erupted. And then, at some point, the someone's rage burst. And in it, he brutally murdered her. After that, he left and denied ever being there. Given those two very different scenarios, I am not sure which to believe. Sean Millian, the out-of-work baker, who was later convicted and hung for Julia Bulette's murder, always claimed he did not commit it. He readily admits to robbing her, but he claimed that she was already dead when he entered her house. Even as he could see the gallows from his jail window, he denied doing the murder. His consistent story was that he was peering into various houses around midnight and he saw a light in the window of her house. When he looked in, he saw Bulette's body lying in a bloody spread eagle in the bedroom. Then, he went in and stole whatever he thought might be valuable. He always said he did not know Julia Bulette, that he had never seen her before he saw her body. In Millian's trial, much was also made of his attack on another prostitute. It had been the basis for his initial arrest. But in repeated questioning on multiple occasions, he said that the prostitute had hit him first, hitting him several times with a large board. After she kept striking him, he became angry and then attacked her. Of course, the hurdy had a different version for the town's marshals. So, it is believable that the French baker may have been just a prowler and a burglar. Not a murderer. Which means for me, both scenarios are still plausible. I am still not sure which to believe. However, for the 3,000 observers at the hanging, the case closed permanently when the trap door of the gallows swung open and Sean Millian fell through it. Lately, I have been musing that the story would have turned out differently if it had not been for the other woman. I mean the woman who initiated the incident at John Piper's Opera House. Remember, when Julia Bulett went to the concert at the theater on the night of her murder, she was asked to leave her usual seat and take one instead in the section reserved for the naughty women. Someone had complained that she should not be allowed to sit in the section of the theater reserved for the decent and respectable patrons. No doubt the complainer was someone with influence with the theater's proprietor. Separating the decent and respectable from the rowdy and naughty patrons made some sense. The decent and respectable sought a quiet, sedate, refined experience. The rowdy and naughty were heavy drinkers, wore scanty attire, and were probably both loud and vulgar. Yet, by all accounts, Julia Bulett was dressed modestly and behaved in a way appropriate for the decent and respectable section. My writer's mind sees the complainer as a mine superintendent. I have seen a demographic analysis of Virginia City at the time of the Comstock strike. In the middle 1860s, the Comstock strike employed 12 mine superintendents. All 12 of the superintendents lived in a home with a wife. On the other hand, among the common miners, there was only one woman for every 2,400 men. Almost no common miner lived in a home with a wife. My theory is a mine superintendent takes his wife to Piper's Opera House for an evening's entertainment. The wife, seeing Julia Bulett, springs into action complaining about indecent women sitting in the wrong section of the theater. The mine superintendent goes to the theater's manager who tells the usher to immediately reseat Miss Bulett. But, I ask, how did the wife of the mine superintendent know that she was a disreputable woman? The answer, I believe, is that the mine superintendent may have been a regular customer of Miss Julia. To continue, the wife knows about the relationship and wants the offending party publicly humiliated. The social class system is used as a weapon of feminine revenge. It angers Bulett, but she can do nothing about it. Later, when Julia Bulett is buried, she is denied burial in the consecrated cemetery. What to make of this extended ramble through the life of Nevada's most famous fallen angel? My answer is that life in the Old West was complicated, complex, and often confusing. Those were not simpler, more pristine times. Men were not more honest, the women were not more trustworthy. Both the really good guys and the most dire of villains wore white hats. Both also wore black, and both sometimes wore pert and stylish bonnets. The noble pioneers who sacrificed everything to save others also plundered, killed, lied, and stole. And the good King James Bible was often quoted to justify almost anything. Good and evil, evil and good coexisted simultaneously. They existed simultaneously in the same person, in the same town, and in the same historical moment. They still do today. In that, nothing has changed. If Julia Bulett had died of yellow fever, tuberculosis, or the dysentery, no one would have noticed her passing. She may have been the exact same person with all of the same positive attributes, but the story would have disappeared in days. It is only because of her murder that she is remembered today. It is her murder that makes her story grist for today's Virginia City tourist guides. It was her murder that motivated the volunteer fireman to buy her a $141 casket. It was her murder that motivated the same fire company men to march behind her hearse singing "The Girl I Left Behind Me." And, if Julia Bulette had been only a fine seamstress, her story would also have died with her. What made her story gain push was that she was not only a seamstress, but also a part-time prostitute. In fact, most of the sensationalist press never made note of her seamstress role. She was the ravishing Creole beauty who wore sable capes, had diamonds for every finger, and had emerald earrings that had once belonged to an Indian Raj. She rode throughout the state in her one-of-a-kind carriage, with its gold-trimmed wheels, and silver door handles, all pulled by four matched black Arabian stallions. No doubt about it. Having a prostitute to write about gave the press boys an opportunity to release their deepest fantasies. Julia Bulette was neither the first nor the last Virginia City prostitute to have been brutally murdered. When I reviewed the old newspapers, I found that on average two women were murdered each year during the height of the Comstock era. To be sure, nearly all of the murdered women were regarded as hurdies. And the perpetrators were quickly apprehended. Julia Bulette was the only woman, I found, representing the higher class ladies. But, her story was the only one that persisted. It was told and retold over the West, and then across the whole country. Thank the press boys for that. The hanging of an unemployed French-speaking baker did not erase all doubts. There are those who believe her actual killer went undiscovered and unpunished. To some, Julia Bulette's murderer walked behind her casket, among the other volunteer firemen, singing maudlin Civil War songs. I started down this road because my good friend had just finished his well-researched historical biography of Julia Bulette. And I was a little piqued when I realized that he had done it before me. It has been nearly 2 years, and just the other day, I found Doug's book on a dusty shelf in my office. I blew off the dust and looked again at his photograph on the flyleaf cover. He really looks very handsome. It is a great picture. Maybe someday I'll read his book.